Case number 19-4124, United States of America versus Pablo Archiveta, United States versus Sylvia Leon. Argument not to exceed 10 minutes for each defendant and 20 minutes for plaintiff. Mr. Jeffrey Lazarus will be arguing first for the appellants.
And Mr. Lazarus, it's my understanding that you reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
That's correct, Your Honor.
You may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Jeff Lazarus, on behalf of the appellant Sylvia Leon. The district court erred in imposing a 16-level enhancement and setting the loss amount in this case at $2.5 million. In this case, the actual and intended loss were actually $102,000. The district court improperly relied on the commentary to the guidelines, specifically application note 3F, in determining the loss amount. This court in Havis held that the guidelines commentary receives no deference if the commentary is inconsistent with or expands the guideline text. For all theft and fraud cases, the offense level is set by the amount of actual or intended loss, losses that bear some relation to reasonably foreseeable pecuniary harm to the victim. Application note 3F, however, creates an artificial loss amount that has no relation to pecuniary harm. The special rule has no rational...
Counsel, what it does is it says that for every device, you impute a $500 loss, right?
That's correct.
But in entering the plea, your client admitted that those numbers were possessed with the intention of using them.
No, Your Honor, I don't think that's correct. He possessed them, but there's nothing that says that he possessed heat with the intent to use them in any way. In fact, they just lay dormant because he was specifically seeking credit card numbers that were specifically tied to Sam's Club accounts, of which he found two out of the 5,000. The other, 4,900 remaining cards lay dormant, and he had no intent of using them whatsoever.
But he did. He didn't want to use those just to keep them and put them in his pocket, did he? I mean, he had those with intent to do something.
No, Your Honor, I don't think that's the case at all. I don't think there's any evidence to support that he ever had an intention to utilize them in any way. He wasn't looking for those. He had no intention of using those, and the government has not presented any evidence of that.
I'm struggling with the plea agreement language because I can understand your argument that they only intended to take Sam's cards and use them, and that was the intent. So that's intent and actual were the same. But the language says that they stole and possessed account information for approximately 4,900 credit and debit cards accounts, with the intention of re-encoding said account information into counterfeit access devices and conducting retail transactions. That sounds like it's an admission as to the 4,900. How is it not?
Your Honor, if the plea is ambiguous, then I think the ambiguity should err in our favor. But as to the two credit cards, though, that was his intent to re-encode those cards as he did. But there's been no evidence.
Does the language refer to 4,900?
Your Honor, if you could point me to the specific portion of the plea agreement that you're referring to.
Well, I tell you what, you continue your argument and we will look at that because I'm quoting what I read to you was a quote out of the plea agreement.
Okay, Your Honor. Your Honor, the special rule in this case that we're dealing with has no rational connection to loss as defined by the guidelines. It is inconsistent with the text of the guidelines and should be given no deference. In Havis, this court held it was an unreasonable reading of the guidelines text defining controlled substance offense to include contempt crimes, and as a result, the commentary deserved no deference. Similarly, it is unreasonable to read loss to include the automatic $500 figure each time a credit card is involved, even when there is no actual or intended loss to that victim. The $500 figure in this case was completely random and has no connection whatsoever to loss, but stands in contradiction with the other guidelines' rules on defining loss. the Sentencing Commission has made clear that loss includes actual and intended losses. In this case, Mr. Leon's conduct in possessing these credit cards made no actual loss to the cardholder. Further, there is no evidence he intended to use these cards in any manner, and thus there is no intended loss. There was no pecuniary harm or reasonably foreseeable pecuniary harm at all as it relates to these other credit card numbers.
There's some other cases that suggest that the hassle and problem for the card holder is a pecuniary loss. Why is that not accurate?
Well, Your Honor, pecuniary harm defined by Application Note 3A says it does not include emotional distress.
So well, what about having to hire an entity to monitor your credit account, or even an attorney or someone else to deal with problems for your personal credit rating?
Well, Your Honor, those are actual losses, and they can be, if those had actually been presented, they could have been actual losses in this case. None were presented, but more importantly, the guidelines don't consider any of those factors. They put a blanket $500 amount on every credit card, no matter whether there is no loss or whether there is a $40 monitoring fee for a year or a $20 to replace the card. But the disconnect between the $500 number and the actual practical implications of this shows just how unreasonable this guideline is and how this $500 number came out of thin air when the Sentencing Commission passed it in 2001. There is no empirical data, no type of studies, no actual evidence that $500 represents the actual losses or intended losses of a victim in this case. And following Havis, that is improper. The Sentencing Commission never put this guideline through the notice and comment period and therefore never gave an opportunity to present this empirical evidence. Therefore, it is...
What can you distinguish? What makes Murphy, United States v. Murphy, a 2020 case also distinguishable?
Your Honor, in that case, the court, and I believe Your Honor was on that panel, was dealing with losses to a business. And in that case, the district court actually did not impose the special rule. The $500 multiplier had nothing to do with that case. That only this court actually found that Murphy had imposed a actual reasonably foreseeable harm of about $7 per victim. This court actually went through and applied the intended loss amount. Now, in that case, Murphy did try to apply Havis, and this court, rightfully so, did say that Havis didn't apply, but that's a separate argument from what we're making here. And it should also be noted that in Murphy, the court found that there was a $7.50, I believe, amount per victim, whereas here we have a $500 amount. And that $500 amount is completely inconsistent with any actual loss figures that is representative of what is going on here. In this case, Mr. Leon had no intention, and there's been no evidence presented that he planned on doing anything with these remaining cards, only the cards that he did make fraud purchases on, which constituted $102,000, the actual loss amount, and that should be the loss amount in this case. Therefore, we are asking this court to vacate the sentence and remand to the district court for resentencing without the imposition of the 16-level enhancement. Thank you.
Counsel, take a look at PID 149 to 150 at paragraph 29 of the plea. While opposing counsel is arguing, I think that's the reference to the part of the plea.
I will take a look at that and address it in my rebuttal then, Your Honor. Thank you.
I think we'll hear from
Mr. Chrisman.
Yes.
Thank you very much, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm Leif Chrisman on behalf of Pablo Archuleta. Pablo Archuleta is a co-defendant with Mr. Sylvia in this case. Our positions are identical with respect to the appeal, although I did add a role reduction argument with respect to my client. Listening to my colleague's arguments before the court, Your Honor, I believe maybe some of the confusion with respect to the court's questions about possessing the 4,900 credit cards. What the logistics of this, of how it actually worked, was that the defendants would install on a gas pump a device that would read credit cards, so it would collect that information. Then they would sort through those and decide which ones would be able to be used at Sam's Club. That's why my client's given the two-level enhancement for possession of device-making equipment. So they didn't actually have these, you know, 5,000 credit cards in their hands. They had to specifically make the ones that they were going to use. So that, I think, shows their intent to only use the ones that they actually made. They didn't.
They had the numbers of the credit cards. Isn't that correct?
That's correct.
Those are a sellable. Those are sold all the time. Is that correct?
I suppose in theory, Judge, that's something that you hear about, you know, ending up on the dark web and, you know, people can buy these. But that, I don't think there was any evidence that there was any intent on our client's part to do anything with the credit card that they, that their skimmer acquired, other than to be able to sort through them and actually create credit cards that they could use at Sam's Club. My client joined the conspiracy probably about a year or so after it started. He is responsible for a smaller amount of loss, $90,000, and the only took place at specifically Sam's Club stores. So maybe if there had created more of these cards or use them in other places, but you can tell from this particular conspiracy, the intent was specifically to find cards that would have, that the owners of those cards had Sam Club's memberships and that they were local. So that's why out of 4,900, 5,000 cards or numbers that were acquired, that they only actually produced a couple of these cards on their own device making equipment and actually used those. So it's an arbitrary number to be held responsible for $2.5 million in loss with a 16 level enhancement when the only intent was to create a small amount of cards and use them at a specific store.
They didn't surrender themselves, didn't they? Did they get arrested? I mean, they may have in the future have made more with all these loans and numbers, right?
I suppose that's possible, Your Honor, but certainly this wasn't a new conspiracy. There was, it went on for a number of years, and my belief, based on the evidence and based on everything that transpired in the case, that they only used these cards at Sam's Clubs, and there wasn't any evidence of any sales to anybody else.
How do you distinguish the plea language? Why does that not, why isn't that an admission of intent to use the 4,900?
I think that would sort of counter the arguments that we intended to make the entire time with respect to the imputed loss. I think we consistently deny that there was any intent to use these additional cards, that the only loss amount that the court should consider would be the actual loss, that the $500 number is arbitrary, that there's nothing that the sentencing commission, there's nothing in there that was subject to mandatory congressional review on the commentary notes. So the district court shouldn't be required to follow the text of the application notes based on the Havis ruling, Your Honor.
But if, just to follow up with that question, if your clients entered into a plea agreement that acknowledged that they had intent with respect to the rest of those 4,900 cards, then doesn't your argument sort of fall away?
If that's the case, but possibly, Your Honor, but I don't believe I don't have that portion of the plea agreement with me. I know Mr. Lazarus has taken a look at it, but that's certainly that's new to us as we sit here as defense counsel. I believe that was the intent of our plea agreement. Thank you, Your Honors. If there's no further questions, I would reserve the balance of my time.
Yeah.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Laura Ford, and I'm here on behalf of the United States. There's a couple of points I want to cover before I get into the reason why this court's Moon decision applies and why Havis doesn't change that. First, I want to mention to the court that another panel of this court is looking at application note 3F1, its application in light of Moon and Havis, and that was argued this morning in the context of gift cards. Secondly, I agree with the court that the plea agreement is probably.
When you say in the context of gift cards, these were cards that were actually purchased?
No, Your Honor, in the context of a mail processing employee who was stealing pieces of mail that she believed contained gift cards and was found with a certain number of gift cards when she was intercepted by law enforcement. And the $500 minimum was applied to those gift cards in that case.
Okay. So in this case, if you have a plan or you have a scheme that an intermediate step of which is to collect data, but the scheme is such that there is no intent to use 90% of that data, that it's just collected and then the process picks out what is valuable and leaves all the rest of it. Isn't that contrary to the notion that you count either actual or intended loss?
Well, I think the guidelines, the general rules instruct that you apply the greater of the actual loss or the intended loss. Certainly in this case, as the court was pointing out in the plea agreement, the defendant stipulated that they possessed 4,900.
I'm asking you a hypothetical. If you have a scheme that involves collecting a lot of data, some of which qualifies as a device, but it's undisputed that the scheme is such that 90% of that data is just left there. It's never used. There's no intent to use it. So that when you look at actual or intended loss, including taking the greater of that, there's no intent to use that data. So I'm asking, doesn't that application note conflict with the notion of using actual or intended loss in that factual situation?
Your Honor, I'm not sure I understand. I guess I would need more information as to like what the 10% was. You're saying that in terms of the actual loss, you're saying that it would produce the intended loss would be substantially higher in that factual scenario than the actual loss?
I'm saying not the facts of this case, something similar, okay? It is completely undisputed that this process, this scheme intended to use 10% of the collected data to buy cards and make fraudulent purchases. And that's the undisputed intent of the scheme. Maybe they only ended up using 5 cards, I don't know, but they intended to be able to reap about 10 cards out of it. Doesn't it conflict with the guideline saying the greater of actual or intended loss to say in that situation, no, we're going to use 1,000 cards and multiply it by 500 each?
I would agree that there are some, in a rare instance, there may be some outlier cases where, you know, it may produce a sentence where the court would look at a variance. If application of the guideline would produce a sentence that would result in a sentence that would be unduly harsh, that's certainly not what we have here.
But Judge White's question is different. The question is whether isn't this an addition or a modification of the guideline, as opposed to an interpretation of the guideline, which would make it prescribed by Havis. And think of simple examples. A defendant says, I'm going to obtain 10 card numbers and I'm going to charge $10 to each one, and does it. $10, 10 cards, $100. Under this interpretation, you're saying 3F1 would say, well, the loss is $5,000 because it's $500 times the 10 card numbers. But isn't that an addition? Isn't that a modification of 3A's agreement to accept loss that is the greater of actual loss or intended loss?
Your Honor, before I respond to that, I do want to say that I'm looking at the timer and I think I started at 15 minutes and I think I was supposed to have 20. Because I could be incorrect about that. But no, I don't think it's an addition to, and I think that's squarely addressed by this court in the Murphy decision recently that looked at the general rules, that the main guideline text in this was intentionally left broad to encompass a wide variety of fraud offenses and theft offenses in this case. This is
Murphy a different section?
It is the same
to a different section.
Yes, it is the same application note, but under a different section. But the underlying reasoning still applies because it is analyzing loss in that table under 2B1.1. And so the fact that loss was left undefined applies equally to the application note in this case. The Havis concern is not at all present in this case, because Havis was a very limited in scope with respect to a congressionally blessed definition of the controlled substance offense that was detailed. It provided specific offenses that qualified for instance, for the career offender guideline, and added a completely different offense that was not present in the textual definition. Here, by contrast, you have a guideline that was purposely left broad in scope. And certainly that would have been present when the guidelines were originally formed in the 1987 guideline manual. The argument that the appellants are advancing also would apply to that $100 minimum that was originally present. And I guess I would note that, you know, the appellants are presuming that the application note wasn't vetted through Congress. But this application note that increased the original $100 minimum to $500, that $100 minimum would have been vetted through Congress in 1987. But more specifically, looking at this 2000 amendment that increased the amount to $500, when you look at the Sentencing Commission's website that contains the 2000 amendments, on the very first page, it says that those proposed amendments were submitted to Congress on May 1st. And in preparing for oral argument, I did find that that is borne out by the Federal Register, which is at 65 Federal Register 26880-1. So this is not a situation where an application note was not submitted to Congress, and that fully distinguishes it from Havis. But more specifically, this is not a situation where the application note conflicts with the text of the guideline. There's nothing that's plainly erroneous or internally inconsistent by applying this application note. It is a reasonable application of the word loss in these very difficult to determine fraud cases, and it simply provides a proxy for gauging the seriousness of the harm, the fraud in this case. in determining, because the court is instructed that it has to apply the greater of the actual or the intended loss. And so this is simply a tool to determine what is greater in this case. And it's certainly not an unreasonable application.
The intended loss.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't catch it.
How is that? I assume you're saying that this is a shorthand for the intended loss, but how is it? How is it the intended loss? How does this apply the intended loss?
It is a proxy in this case. I think a reasonable application that a defendant stealing a credit card, I mean, in this day and age, a $500 maximum spending amount would actually be artificially low. And in this context, when you look at the defendants in this case, and in fact, I do want to correct a factual inaccuracy. The defendants or the appellants keep pointing to that there are only two Sam's Club memberships that these purchases were tied to. Well, those were two fictitious memberships, but there were stolen credit cards, a number of them, that were used for the purchases. It was not just two accounts. There were many access devices used, and the government specifically corrected that at page 559 of the sentencing transcript. And even if you want to use two Sam's Club memberships, the facts are even worse for them with that, because then their intended loss, if you split it between two accounts, their intended loss, if there was $100,000 in roughly in these fraudulent purchases, then their intended loss was $50,000 per account. So certainly the $500 minimum proxy for determining their intended loss when they are stealing these credit cards with the intent of re-encoding them and making these fraudulent purchases is reasonable in this case. It is not coming out of thin air. It is grounded in reality that, you know, $500 accounts adequately for the fact that some access devices have different spending limits. Some may be completely unusable. And I think the guidelines, the application note recognizes that by specifically adopting the statutory definition of unauthorized access devices, where Congress defines it as lost, stolen, expired and revoked and canceled access devices. And so by providing a method or a tool for district courts to determine, at least as a starting point, what the intended loss is in these difficult cases, it is deferring to Congress's
Did the defendants at any time, starting with the arrest or later, file anything in the record to show that they intended just to collect these blank cards and throw them in the river or do anything like that?
No, Your Honor, I don't recall anything to that effect. Certainly, you know, the fact that they were caught before they had the opportunity to use these access devices is no defense under the guidelines. You know, they were very calculated in this case in that they were careful about where they made these purchases. They made sure they made these purchases in the same geographic area where they were stealing them to avoid detection. And that's probably why they got away with it for 2 years. But certainly the intent was to continue to make these fraudulent purchases with it. But also I think this recognizes that, you know, in a broader sense that, you know, you can use this as these stolen credit card devices for aggravated identity theft, and they absolutely can be sold on the dark web as well. And that's another harm.
The record indicated that you had argued that there was like 22,000 accesses, and the court said no, 4,900. So what is that distinction? And under your argument on 3F1, then does that mean that anytime there are these massive, massive numbers, no matter what is used, someone could come in and have hundreds of millions of dollars in what would be claimed to be intended loss?
The government did believe that this was kind of the tip of the iceberg, because when you're looking at the 4,900 access devices, you're just looking at what they possessed on that day. So that was divided between two computers and three flash drives, but they were traveling all over the country. I think there was at least six different states. So that's only a snapshot of what was going on that day. And that's why this is a reasonable proxy for determining their loss. Because that's, I guess that's an important point, is that the loss is what was intended when they stole these devices, not what they simply possessed on the day that they were intercepted by law enforcement. But more to the question about with respect to, you know, 100 million, you know, the guidelines have, or the, you know, under Booker, we have a way of protecting against an unduly harsh sentence if in that outlier case where it produces, you know, an extremely high loss amount. But certainly that's not borne out by the facts in this case. It's certainly reasonable for the defendants to think that, you know, there would be a $500 maximum spending amount. That's artificially low today in this climate. Certainly it was a reasonable way of determining what their intended loss was at the time that they stole these cards with the intent of re-encoding them and making these purchases. And they certainly, Your Honor, had the ability and did ask for a variance that was permitted under the plea agreement, and the district court declined to do so. But that certainly is one way of addressing the issue if it produces an unduly harsh sentence under the guidelines, that the court can vary based on the 3553A factors, or I guess it's perhaps similar to maybe a child pornography case could reject the application on policy grounds. But I think that, again, would be tied to the 3553A factors and making a finding that, you know, based on the nature and circumstances of a particular case, an outlier case, that a variance would be warranted, but that would not, those are not the facts here. This is the typical case where somebody was stealing, you know, a large number of credit cards with the intent to commit further fraud. And I would say that the Moon decision from this court, although it determined that there is no usability requirement under the guidelines, that was in the context of substantive reasonableness, but certainly applies equally in terms of the procedural reasonable context here, in terms of the district court's duty to first correctly calculate the guideline range as part of the
Moon was pre-Havis, correct? Moon was pre-Havis, right?
Correct. It was pre-Havis, but Havis has not changed that application. Because there is nothing about this application note that conflicts with the guidelines text, leaving that loss term undefined. It is not internally inconsistent with the guideline itself, and it is not, the application is not plainly erroneous in this case. So the concerns that this court had in the Havis case are completely absent from the special rule in this case for determining intended loss in credit access device theft and fraud cases. So the position would be that Moon still is binding in that case with respect to this application note. There is no usability requirement, and focusing on the actual loss amount wholly ignores the general rule that the district court has to determine both actual and intended loss. And in fact, rejecting the guideline application note and trying to limit it to actual loss would be in contravention to the instruction that the court should determine intended loss in this case, and would produce an internally inconsistent result. And notably, the defendants do not challenge the general rules.
Counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, I think I keep asking you the same question, and I apologize for that, but how is it that this rule of 500 is intended loss? I mean, why not look at all the circumstances, maybe even have a presumption that there's it's 500 per card in the absence of anything else. But why not have a determination of intended loss? That is a finding that this is the intended loss.
I think that would be a much more difficult determination. It's always difficult to determine what a defendant's intent was, but this is a reasonable starting point, particularly with respect to credit cards, where at least would have a maximum spending limit of $500 and adequately accounts for a credit card that's much higher.
You say it's a starting point, and maybe that is what it should be, but my understanding is that it's not a starting point and wasn't treated as a starting point. It was treated as the formula.
It is a formula that the court was required to apply in correctly calculating the guideline range. And I would say it is a starting point in determining the ultimate sentence, because the court then has the discretion under Booker to decide whether it is appropriate based on the 3553A factors to apply that calculation. Your Honor, I see my time is up. Unless this court has further questions, the government would respectfully request that this court affirm the district court's judgment as to both appellants in this case.
Judges, do you have any questions? No? Okay. Rebuttal?
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. And Your Honor, I want to start with the plea agreement issue that the court brought up. I do want the court to know that this plea agreement was executed in March of 2019, months before Havis was ever issued. So this argument didn't become about the application of Havis didn't become abundantly clear until after the plea was made and before sentencing. The court brings up the language from the paragraph that the court referenced, and I'll be honest that was not a reading that either the government or the defense had ever brought up or the district court. I understand that the court could read that ambiguity in, but ambiguities in the plea agreement should resolve in the favor of the defendants. Even so, even if we do assume that there was some evidence that the defendants in this case intended on using some of these cards, there has been no evidence presented that they intended on a loss of $500 or more. What if we use Judge Strantz's example, where they maybe intended on using some of these 4,900 cards to make a $10 purchase per card? In that case, the $10 would be the intended loss. But the guidelines go much farther than that. They make a leap and turn this $10 intended loss into a $500 intended loss, even though there is no dispute that the loss was $10. So in that hypothetical, we go way beyond what the loss application notes provide. And that is the problem here. And Havis provides this court a solution, which is that we can't apply these inconsistent guidelines, that we have to use guidelines that are consistent with the guidelines text. And the actual intended losses are that. And as to the variances, I understand the government's frustration that these 4,900 cards may be lost or not counted, but the district court should properly apply the actual or intended loss and then determine whether a variance is done. In the government's case, they want to set the loss at $2.5 million and rely on the district court to then make a change. And that is not what Havis requires. I see that my time is up. Therefore, we ask this court to reverse the district court's sentence and remand for a redetermination under the proper loss amount. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Christman?
Thank you very much, Your Honor. May it please the court. I had an opportunity to pull up the plea agreement and review it while opposing counsel was arguing. I would just indicate a couple paragraphs that I took a look at. Paragraph 17 in Pablo Archuleta's plea agreement, where the stipulated guideline computation is laid out. Certainly there's no agreement of a plus 16 enhancement for loss there. Also in paragraph 20, it's specifically contemplated that the defendants reserve the right to appeal the court's decision to increase the defendant's sentencing guideline offense level under those disputed enhancements. And certainly speaking specifically to the $500 per credit card issue. So we certainly don't believe that we waived our ability to challenge these provisions or indicating that we agreed that there was an intent for that type of loss, Your Honors. Secondly, there was some questions regarding the Murphy decision. In Mr. Archuleta's reply brief, I specifically addressed Murphy and distinguished that on page 4 of the reply brief, just indicated that the government relied upon Murphy to support its argument that Havis does not affect the application notes of section 2B1.1, but Murphy does not address the special rule created in the application notes. U.S. versus Murphy with the cite there. The issue is not whether the district court properly applied the $500 per access device rule. It's whether the rule itself is proper after the court's decision in Havis. The application notes can define loss amounts, but it cannot create mandatory minimum special rules. Just because the special rule and guidance, although the guidance is mandatory, have been around for decades, doesn't make it proper. And that's appellate brief, page 30. With that, Your Honors, if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Questions? Thank you all. Mr. I believe you're under CJA.
I am, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you all. The case will be submitted.